Just a quick warning that we will be discussing heavy themes like pregnancy loss, abortion, religion, and, as always, big existential questions. This is an unbleeped version of our thoughts as they come to us.
Hello, and welcome to A Hopeless Endeavor, a Joanna Newsom podcast. My name is Sam. I live in Vancouver.
I'm Nikki. I live in Ithaca. And this is part two of our episode on sawdust and diamonds. Without further ado, let's just dive right into this one. Thank you guys so much for listening.
Do you want to read the next one here?
Sure. Yes. Okay. So, and the little white dove made with love, made with love, made with glue and a glove and some pliers, swings a low sickle arc from its perch in the dark. Settle down, my desire. I'm going to stop there because I feel like the next verse gets into some shit.
Yes. It's very frantic, very busy in the next one.
Right. So again, here, the little white dove being made with love. And again, it's the repeating, right, that we were talking about just at the beginning of this episode that is, it seems significant. The little white dove is made with love. It's made with love, then made with glue and a glove and some pliers. Do you have any thoughts about that particular part, Sam?
I have a ton about doves, for sure. Did you know that doves and pigeons are in the same family?
I did not at all.
And so I think it's really poignant that she is being really specific about a little white dove and not like, you know, the zillions of pigeons that at least I see hanging out by the SkyTrain every day.
Right.
Like this very specific mythical creature.
Precious little thing.
Yeah, exactly. So doves are, at least I think, are a symbol throughout this here too. And historically are kind of a symbol of love as peace, but also as messengers. Doves, I mean, I think most obviously as part of the story of Noah's Ark. In Islam, doves and the pigeon family are in general, respected and favored because they are believed to have assisted the final prophet of Islam, Muhammad, in distracting his enemies outside a cave. And a pair of pigeons had built a nest and laid eggs at once, and a spider had woven cobwebs, which in the darkness of the night made the fugitives believe that Muhammad could not be in that cave. And then my note is, did anyone else's brains go straight to all of the spider references that Joanna has in Only Skin and Have One On Me and Go Long?
My God. Me too. Yes, 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 yeah. Yes.
I see you raising your hands over there. And Judaism, again, the story of Noah's Ark, but the Talmud compares the spirit of God hovering over the waters to a dove that hovers over her young. Maybe? A little bit? In post-biblical Judaism, souls are envisioned as bird-like, and that may be derived from the biblical notion that dead spirits chirp, which is really interesting. And just like as a very side note, there is a crater on the moon named Dove to like tie it into all of the void talk from the last couple episodes.
I feel like my so-called research is far less sophisticated than that. It's like more like meditating on what this line makes me feel rather than actually looking at legit sources.
I have that too. But, you know, I spent the first couple days really getting lost in doves and bells.
Well, that is justified because both doves and bells, if I were to pick two things that I think that make a thematic appearance throughout all this, it would be those two things. Mm-hmm. There's something about just the way she phrases made with love,
she's reinforcing made with love. That. Yeah.
It's almost as though to me in that second line, she's like trying to convince herself either that it's not made with love, or like she's trying to get herself to fixate on something other than she's fixating on. So in my little interpretation, and again, like super grain of salt, just take it with a grain of salt. She's saying, like, this little white dove made with love, like, no, made with glue and a glove and some pliers. So in the same way as she was, like, comparing this thing to a rock before, drowning mute as a rock, she's trying to, like, detach herself from the significance that she's imparting on this dove, right? Mm-hmm. And because the two lines are in stark contrast, at least to me, with each other. For something to be made with love is a super different thing from what it means for that thing to be made with these, like, clinical, very human things like glue and a glove and some pliers.
Mm-hmm. It's the next one that gets me too. Swings a low sickle arc. Like, she could have chosen any word to describe that shape. And not only is that a very prominent image on the cover of the album.
Right.
But it's a blade, right? Like, it's a violent thing.
Yes.
I think it was ingenious that... but too, the use of pliers as well here. And again, it was Jack's email that mentioned the use of, like, surgical instruments or tools. And I think that's very prominent in this verse.
Can I be really self-indulgent for a second?
Please.
I was so happy to discover that I was, like, reading the Genius annotations for this, and I read the, like, sickle reference and how, like, it is talking about death, that it's probably not an accident that it's talking about death. And I was like, oh my God, it's me that said that. I didn't see it. And then I was like, Nikki Fortune. I was like, what? Oh my God. I guess a long ass time ago I said that.
That's funny. Then really, I'm referencing you.
That's so weird. But one thought that was not mine that I read, I think, on Genius, because there's just very few sources, again, for Status and Diamonds, but that it's fun to think about what its perch in the dark might be referring to. Mm-hmm. And to me, I'm so sorry to keep bringing it back.
I think the majority of people probably agree with you, and this is a part that needs to be heard regardless. Because I'm, like, pushing against it doesn't mean that it's not a part of it, for sure. So go for it.
Okay. Thank you. But, like, for the record, it's not that I disagree with you. I think that you're absolutely right. This song is about way fucking more than just the fact that she might have had an abortion or a miscarriage or whatever it might be.
That the narrator might have had.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Of course. That the narrator might have had an abortion or a miscarriage. But that it's not solely and uniquely focused on this one experience. It's about this whole, everything surrounding. Mm-hmm. It's about the experience of being, like, a human in the way that is really nuanced. And I think that Joanna gives us in a way that is, it's really special. But anyways, so if we are going with this fetus interpretation, the idea that this fetus is swinging this low sickle arc from its perch in the dark. So A, the sickle arc, obviously referencing death, but then B, also the perch in the dark, maybe calling back to the void that we've been talking about for, I feel like, the past million episodes. Like, like the void that, like, when you were saying, like, your mom had said that before you guys were born, you were just twinkles in her eye. Totally, or, like... Yeah. And what I think Joanna does throughout numerous albums is that she associates birds with these unformed beings, these, like, without having, like, crossed into the world of, like, our game that we're playing. She associates these birds with these whatever, like, potential souls, and that this bird, from its void, from its perch in the void, swings this death arc. It, like, comes down to say hello, but also just to be like, hey, I'm done.
See you never. Yeah,
right. See you never. And then her on Genius, it says that it goes, swings a low sickle arc from its perch in the dark, colon, settle down my desire. And I don't even know what to make of that, other than, like, that the idea that she has to tame her own desire in response to or in connection with the previous line is so sad.
And is it the desire to, I agree with you that it's kind of like a suppression of, is it a suppression of the made with love or like the personification of something that may or may not be, or is it the suppression of the opposite of that? I don't know.
Yeah, totally. And it doesn't, like, come to think of it, like, everything that I'm saying about, like, the potential abortion reference is super easily sort of revoked, in the sense that someone, when you're, if you have a breakup with someone, it's really easy to, like, you know, imagine what your future would have been like with that person. And if you're someone who decides that they want to have children together, it's really easy to start picturing that as like a fully fleshed out life. Mm-hmm. And so without any, even if the narrator is not talking about specifically anything to do with pregnancy, she's just talking about this life that she had imagined. Mm. Like, that life that she had imagined is itself dead, right? Is disconnecting itself from her.
Right, and settle down the desire to either imagine what might have been, yeah, or literally put that into action.
Right. Or like the desire literally for like the other person, yeah, you know? Like, yeah, you know, when like sometimes things just don't work and you have to like resign yourself to that fact, but you're like, no, but there's still something there, mm-hmm, that's like not enough to hold on to, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Would you like to read the next verse if you have nothing else to say?
The next one is, "And the moment I slept, I was swept up in a terrible tremor." And at this point, we're going. Like, the music behind is frantic. It's busy. Like, the strings that she's hitting are wild. Yeah, it'd be fun to listen along as we do this, but I think that's a bit much for us right now. So this verse is, yeah. "And the moment I slept, I was swept up in a terrible tremor, though no longer bereft, how I shook and I couldn't remember. And then the furthermost shake drove a murdering stake in and cleft me right down through my center. And I shouldn't say so, but I know that it was then or never."
Oh my God, it makes me want to throw up. It's so good.
Yeah. My first question here is, are we back in like the dream state? Are we back on the staircase? Because she's asleep. The moment I slept, I was swept up in a terrible tremor.
She's dropping these hints that we're not supposed to take it super literally, mm-hmm, right? We're like going back and forth in like her consciousness, and what she's thinking and what we have access to is not necessarily like what is. Mm-hmm. Right?
And bereft, defined is deprived of or lacking something. So now that maybe the narrator is back in this dream, I have a question. All is well? Obviously it's not. But they're trembling, they're shaking, they're no longer missing whatever piece was missing back in reality. And I felt like maybe they're not even able to really fully remember what that missing piece was. I couldn't remember.
Right. So more than almost any other verse in this song, I want to say that this verse is the thing that makes me most convinced that we are likely talking about some kind of abortion here. And again, it's super cool if people disagree with me, including Sam. I like that. But for me, at least, the reason that I get, well, a couple things about just this verse is, when she's describing herself as having fallen asleep, and then within this sleep, within this dream, she's no longer bereft. So she is no longer lacking something, mm-hmm, that apparently she was before she fell asleep, right? So in my head, it's like she has lost this baby. She's had an abortion, and she is no longer missing this thing. In her dream, maybe she is still whatever, pregnant or whatever. And then the murdering stake in and cleft me right down through my center is super just, to me, abortion-y. Like, that, I don't even know how else to say it. Like, that someone would have drove, murdering is like an old, I think, English way, mm-hmm, to say murdering, right? A murdering stake in and like split me right down through my center. And like you're, when you like, even though speaking of a center of a human being is like kind of nonsensical, when you think of what your center is, it's very much like your torso, not your limbs, right? And like for like people with uteruses, it's very much like right there, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, and from the other perspective of more of a general loss, the center as a heart.
Yeah.
And a little bit less the womb. But then again, the word, like the specific word choice of murdering steak is so close to mothering. Yeah. And I want to say that that's intentional. Like we talked about the motherlessness.
In Emily.
In Emily from Humbert Humbert in Lolita. And I can't not connect that.
I love that you made that connection, actually. I didn't even, but you're right. Like
I didn't until you said word. It. It's a weird word. I've heard it nowhere but here, which doesn't surprise me at all because, you know, most of my new vocabulary comes from this.
Actually, but... I've heard people ask, like interviewers ask Joanna about, and again, this is not an interview I've seen recently, so like very much paraphrasing, mm-hmm. but I've heard interviewers ask her, like, why do you use such crazy words? Like, are you trying to be, I don't know, whatever, old English? And she's like, no, I think that it's really fucking stupid to use complicated words for the sake of using complicated words. She's just like, she has said before, like, I just choose the thing that most perfectly describes what I'm talking about. And for a lot of my songs, it sort of comes to me in this way that, like, I have never, ever experienced, but a bunch of songwriters have expressed that, like, you are, like, the vessel through which these songs are produced. So, like, the words come to you and you're like, oh, my God, that's the fucking perfect word. Mm-hmm. And so she had described that sort of process as like there's just no other word that I could have chosen. This was the word that it had to be. And so like taking her at that word and like thinking that she's not trying to just be like weirdly cool or like hippie or not hippie, like hipster mm-hmm. in like using these old English words, right? Like I like that comparison, Sam.
I think I noted too that this injury comes from the furthermost place. Like,
yeah,
much as we talked about, like, the ringing of a bell coming from a distance, this injury occurs from a furthermost place. The shake comes from a distance. And I want to believe if we are back in, like, this dream world, that this stake comes from reality. And I mean, whatever the fuck reality is at this point. And is something that shocks the narrator and pulls them from this dream. And maybe it's not even a dream. Maybe it's something like a suspended state of disbelief or disassociation. But like you said, like the stake divides them in two, like splits them in half. And again, like the last line there, and I shouldn't say so, but I know that it was then or never. And that to me just describes some kind of forced choice. Either a decision has been made or it has to be made, but it's now or never. And you know what? And again, like if we think about the myth of yeast, the princess walking up to the gate that she must know holds back the ocean, right? And deciding to or being convinced to take that key anyway and let the ocean in is also like a now or never decision.
And you know that feeling of like, I don't know if you've made decisions that are like this, but like the feeling that's like, if I say the thing I'm about to say, I'm unlocking like a floodgate of shit that is going to come, right? So like breaking up with someone kind of feels like that when you're like, if I say this, like that is it. It is an action that is, and like a lot of times it is now or never.
Mm-hmm. You can't take it back once it's said. You can't, it's opening the gates in a sense.
Right, exactly. And letting the floods in. Yeah, like I'm very, I don't know if it's just my philosophy self being really hung up on free will questions throughout this album, but to me, there's like an interesting way in which she phrases this whole verse, which is like, look, I was swept up in this terrible tremor. I was, I shook. I couldn't remember. Like, what could she not remember? Unclear. And then the furthermost shake, it's this thing that she's not doing, right? Mm-hmm. It's an action that's sort of happening to mm-hmm. her, right? This furthermost shake drove, I didn't drive. Mm-hmm. This shake drove a murdering stake in. So, like, what element of she's not at least conveying to us that she has made this, like, super free choice to do whatever is in question. It's she's describing whatever event takes place as something that has happened to her. And then almost further, like, solidifying that idea with that last line, I shouldn't say so, but I know that it was then or never. That's like very much like you don't have a choice. Mm-hmm. Like you're pushed into whatever decision is happening.
And like the realization that, you know, you shouldn't say it, that maybe there's another actor at play here who is either telling yeah. you, or it's very heavily implied that this is not something right. that can be spoken about.
Right. And like, I don't know what the then or never refers to. Then I knew it was then or never, that like then I should tell this person the thing that I, you know, have been waiting to tell them. Mm-hmm. Then that I should abort this thing. Some people think that it's then that I should like decide to have the baby. Like some people think that that is in fact what's going on through this song. I'm sorry if I haven't given that train of thought enough credence throughout this whole thing. I just don't really get how that how to express that point of view, but I again don't want to say that that's not what's happening because I don't fucking know. Yeah. But yeah, I think there's a whole bunch of different ways to take this last line. I have no insightful things to say.
The next verse I feel probably the most lost with.
Me too.
If you want to read it, go ahead.
Okay, so she says, push me back into a tree, bind my buttons with salt, fill my long ears with bees, praying, please, 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 love, you ought not, no, you ought not. And again, I'm going to stop there because I think that the vibe that's happening throughout this verse is different than the previous one and different from the next one.
And musically, we've kind of slowed down a little bit.
The like change in like, I don't know how to do it other than like, it's like higher in like the thing that she's doing. So I was talking to our mutual like best friend, Alicia. She's a wonderful human being.
An angel on earth,
a brilliant, glorious human that we're both so lucky to know and love. She was texting me the other night about something that I just never would have known of or about without her insight, which is that, let me just find the thing in my notes. It's funny because I don't really follow my notes as we're talking, but I make these very extensive ones before we go. So she is much more musically adept than I think either of us are. And she was telling me how at this very point, there is a musical phenomenon called counterpoint. Mm-hmm. And here, so that is just a term for when one or more melodies are added above or below another melody, and that they're played together. So it's melody against melody, mm-hmm. like literally translated. So it's like not rhythmic chords behind whatever the person is singing. It's this whole other fucking thing that's happening on top of this new thing that's happening. And if you can picture the harp going up, she's like doing this like very like, I can't fucking do it, but like, and then
yeah,
it goes up.
It's a higher
in
chord.
This way that,
or something. Yeah.
It's a higher something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so Alicia was saying like, look, it's melody against melody here. So she intensifies things with whatever she's fucking doing musically, please reach out to us if you know, because we don't have a fucking idea.
Obviously.
Right, obviously. But she's like upping the ante, I guess, in like a way here. And it just feels way more frantic and drastic and almost nonsensical and a little bit crazy making.
And in like contrast to kind of the slower words at this point too, like there's this verse just in general has less words than the last few. Yeah. And they are pronounced more slowly. So like
that's a really good
point. While maybe like the cadence of the music is really picking up, like the prosody of the words, the like tenor of the words is really in contrast to that at this point.
I didn't even think of that, but that's a great point, because you're right that like the feeling of the music is way more like frantic, mm-hmm. but then it like corresponds with this feeling you might have when you're getting in touch with like sort of your animalistic self or something that's very like, I don't know, if you've ever had like panic attacks or something, like you're not a super like verbose person at that. At least I'm not like very verbose when I am having like panicky moments, mm-hmm. right? Like I get way more in touch with the way that something feels, and the music is almost doing that to us in this moment. It's being frantic with the way that it feels and diminishing the words, and you're right, slowing them down and also making them way more abstract than we've seen so far.
I had such a hard time with the abstraction in this verse.
Like, what is she talking about? I don't know.
So the notes that I have, first of all, in my notes I have that we're back in some kind of reality now, only because the metaphors are very present. We have trees, we have buttons and salt, we have ears and bees, which are all much more relatable things. And the first note that I have was from in our Emily episode, M.M. Wright had sent us this incredible document. And she had mentioned within that Mayropi, if you remember from that episode, also means eloquent and bee eater and mortal.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
Bee eater? Like bumblebee eater?
Yes.
Wow.
And that bee eater refers to a genus of birds, which includes doves.
Whoa.
Right? So oh my thank God. You M.M. Wright for that. I had like it was in the back of my mind and I had to go back and confirm that for this episode. So connection to Emily there. And then like I feel like I'm really reaching with the bind my buttons with salt, besides like the literal meaning of sewing or binding together a garment or a body with salt, and salt is a glue. If glue hasn't already been mentioned already, I know it's a coming. But it makes me want to...
It has been.
It has been. Okay, then.
Yeah.
And like the only way that you can literally bind something with salt is with meat. Like it's something... I know. Sorry. But it's something that that holds a flesh together. And it made me want to reference back. I'll move away from that now. I'm sorry. To the clothing.
No, I think it's good.
In Monkey and Bear. So her threadbare coat, her apron full of boulders, the fancy clothes, the leash.
Yeah.
Like a binding or a sewing back together of that. You know, in Monkey and Bear, she's darning those holes every night over and over.
Yeah. And even in relation to this song, she is maybe... detaching herself from her body, yes. in a way that I think is really interesting. Mm-hmm. So she's like viewing bodiness, embodiedness, as like this separate thing, this like very, our bodies are not the thing that matters. It's like the spirit or the soul or whatever that is the thing that matters. And so like the button, the binding of the flesh is not, I don't know, as traumatizing or something as it would be if it were this thing that we weren't able to detach from, maybe. I don't know.
And like binding as in the stake has split her into, the shake has split her into, and like what can be done to heal that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. All three of these. So push me back into a tree, bind my buttons with salt, and fill my long ears with bees. Even though I don't really know what any of these things mean, other than maybe push me back into a tree, which is just like the literal interpretation of it. Even though I don't know, it still seems as though there is some common vibe to the three lines here. And the vibe is like, incapacitate me.
Is it like the narrator is wanting to ignore everything that has happened?
Right, exactly. Like, don't let me be a human with agency right now. I want to, like,
out of my body.
It's the same, like, yeah. Like, this is very, I wish this were not the case with me, but in any, like, emergency or panicky situation, like, literally my first instinct is to, like hide myself. I want to just, like,
exactly.
Close my eyes, shut my ears. Like, I don't want to hear it. And so when she's saying, like, push me back into a tree, bind my buttons with salt. Like, don't let me move. Don't give me a choice. I want to, like, not have agency in this respect.
Like, close my eyes, heal my wounds, cover my ears. Like we were talking about.
Don't make me make the choice.
Don't make me do it. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And then that corresponds with the next line where she's praying, please, please, please. She's begging for something. Love, you ought not. No, you ought not.
And there's that you again, too.
Right. Yeah.
Which is a specific something or someone. And also just like the fill my long ears with bees. Like we talked about the white noise of the water earlier. It makes me think of as something that's deafening, as something that's violent in a way. Something to.
I would not want to have my ears filled up with bees. Mm. That sounds scary. Or any of these things actually could be really violent.
Yeah.
Right. So the push me back into a tree has this like connotation of like, look, like not only incapacitate me, but like also be a bit violent towards me. Right. Like be a bit abusive. Also, it's not clear that she's giving the person a command saying like, do this to me.
It's almost to herself. Like she's willing this to happen.
Yes.
And maybe is not able to do it. The narrator is not able to do it for herself, but she is wishing that it would happen anyway. And like you said, incapacitated. Like if they are in a dreamlike state of some sort, if all of this is happening around them, like, stop.
Yeah, please, exactly. Please. Stop. Yeah. That like, without being able to put to words why that is the case, that is the vibe that I get from this verse. Is just like, stop. Like, I just don't want to deal with it.
Yeah.
And then you ought not. No, you ought not. I don't know. There's a million different things we could think. We could think if it's an abortion, like, you ought not have the abortion. You could think that if she's talking to the other person, it's like, no, you ought not pressure me into doing something, or you ought not do whatever it is that you're doing. It could be like,
I don't want to hear like this.
Actually, any number of things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't want to hear this. Right. Or even, I don't know, whatever. Even contrasting what she had said before, if she's begging the person to do something, and then like later she's saying, you ought not, no, you ought not. Maybe she's giving like this contradictory information to the person, like, do X to me, but actually you should not do X. Mm-hmm. You ought not do X.
Like that indecision.
Right. And like almost, I don't want to, like, I very much hesitate to call any woman ever crazy, because it's a very sexist thing that can be used against us, but that like also there is a certain element of like losing your shit involved in this song. And I very much relate to the feeling of wanting something from some person, but then being like, no, like, I actually don't want that. You need to be more responsible than this like base desire that I have for you, right? I don't know. These like contrasting desires, I think, are not foreign.
No, to us. Not at all. And that brings us to the next verse, which is, and then the system of strings tugs on the tip of my wings. And in brackets, cut from cardboard and old magazines, makes me warble and rise like a sparrow. And in the place where I stood, there is a circle of wood, a cord or two, which you chop and you stack in your barrow. It is terribly good to carry water and chop wood, streaked with soot, heavy-booted and wild-eyed. As I crash through the rafters and the ropes and the police trail after, and the holiest belfry burns sky high.
Like, this is the only time in which you and I have not been like bopping along.
It's too we're heavy like somber. To bop.
We're like, exactly, it's not a dancing song. And this is like, we are taking this seriously. Yeah.
I know you said a lot of this, a lot about the circle of wood. In the beginning, and I know that like the definition of a chord is very boring. It's like the rectangular shape in which wood can be stacked. And so I don't want to reference that. But I think it was genius that also tied us back to like a chord. Ooh, yeah, a chord as a unit of measurement, a chord as you play on an instrument, but also, you know, like this one, an umbilical cord.
Yep. Also, too, if we're thinking back to the like puppet references mm-hmm. that we've been talking about, and we take this whole verse in stride, so like the system of strings, so imagine this just being a puppet for a second, mm-hmm. a system of strings tugs on the tip of my wings, like jerking the thing upward and like animating it, mm-hmm. and like further enforced by the fact that this thing is cut from cardboard and old magazines, so like is forged in this way that like does not sound natural, and again like sort of disassociates like the humanness of a person with their body, mm-hmm. Makes me warble and rise like a sparrow. And then in the place where I stood, there's a circle of wood or cord or two, which you chop and you're stacking your barrow. So if we're talking about the chords and strings being synonymous here, then so like obviously it's one of those like poly, whatever I said before, poly, let me just check because I want to get this right, poly semi words where she is, I think, intentionally saying like, look, a cord is a measurement of wood. Mm-hmm. So a cord or two, which you chop and you stack in your barrow, but also in reference to the like puppetry that we were just talking about. If we replace cord with string, like a string or two, which you chop and you stack in your barrow, makes it seem like he's cutting her off. He's cutting these like things that animate her off. He's like incapacitating her in this way that
like the stake
kind of breaks my heart.
Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. Like the stake did. And like, I don't know for what purpose, it seems like very cold. So the next line is that it's terribly good to carry water and chop wood, which is just a straight up reference to the, I don't have it up. Let me just see. Like the Buddhist line that is like, it's something like before enlightenment, carry water and chop wood, and after enlightenment, carry water and chop wood.
Before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. This is called to be present in all things you do, and that life does not end once you achieve enlightenment.
Right. So on the one hand, it's like, just like sort of keep your head down and do your work. And like enlightenment isn't this like, like place that you reach and then like everything's glorious afterwards. Like, no, it's about learning to deal with our circumstances as we have to face them, I guess. I don't know. But then also like in this sort of darker context, this cord that he has chopped and stacked in his barrow, it makes me think of you know, in Have One On Me, like the in Go Long, she says, the room, I have never seen such a terrible room. I've just seen such a terrible, gilded with the gold teeth of the women who loved you. And so it like brings to mind this like wall of teeth or something that he has collected from these women. Mm-hmm. And like when she's talking about stacking these cords that have animated her into this barrow, it's like, ugh, like what's this guy up to? Like, he seems vicious and like cold, just really cold. I also read on Genius that barrow is both like a wheelbarrow, but also Old English language for a grave. So a grave mound. And so on that interpretation, it's like this like wood that you are preparing for your grave. It's just very much just existentially, I don't know, scary.
As you were talking, it made me think of the Fiona Apple song, Ladies, from her newest album, where she's talking about, like, take it easy when he leaves me. be my guest to whatever I left in the kitchen cupboards, in the closets, in the cabinets. There's a dress in the closet. Like, it's like these, I mean, it's more vicious in the Sawdust and Diamond lyrics. Like, it's almost like awards, like memoirs, like vicious memoirs of women. Dude, he's been venom genderizing of... all of this. Obviously, in a way.
I feel like it's fair.
May or may not.
Yeah, I think it does. but I get your hesitancy. I'm just like super okay with quoting these things as masculine and feminine. But yeah, so it makes me think of, and I like, until you said that, I was not going to make this reference, but it really made me think of, because I'm really into true crime, you guys. It's like this embarrassing fucking obsession that I have. And this like very commonly spoken about thing about serial killers is that they take trophies of their crimes. So a lot of serial killers will like take whatever, like the ID of a person that they've murdered, and like just have these collections, like these like trophies of their of various quote unquote accomplishments, right, in their killings. And it brought to mind that for me. Again, probably just because I'm obsessed with true crime in a way that no one else is, and that's probably not what's going on here at all, but it made me think of that. Just these like things that you collect from someone. And actually, like the Go Long lyric that I had just referenced, like really, really, really makes me think of that. That, God, the room is gilded with the gold teeth of these women who loved you. What happened to them?
It's an excess, right? And a cord as a measurement is not a small amount of wood. Like, a cord as a measurement is a lot of wood. Like, it's enough to get you through a few weeks, I want to say, at least, of fires, of keeping yourself warm. So, like, it's a gross reference as a trophy, but, like, to think of it in that way is kind of enormous and disgusting.
Yeah, it is disgusting. Also, the following line where she says, "It is terribly good to carry water and chop wood." Mm-hmm. The word terribly there is something that she's inserting into this equation, where she's referencing that Buddhist line that we had just talked about, but also like she's inserting this terribly line, which again is this terribly word, which again is bringing this element of violence into this lyric that I think is hard, that we shouldn't ignore. And like, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, Sam, but like for me, like, I don't know. I've had this like, I talked about a few episodes ago, I don't remember when, but how I don't think that really we have free will. And like for a period in my 20s at some point, it made me like this like philosophizing about these like concepts made me be like kind of a pushover, in that I'd be like, well, look, no one's to blame. So I have to like succumb to everybody else's desires and like, whatever, like just sort of bend myself to the will of everybody else. And it for some reason brings that to mind for me here, because she said, like, on the one hand, she's like trying to like repeat this mantra to herself where she's like, no, look, it's good to just like learn to not be bothered by the shit that you would be tempted to be bothered by, in this very like Buddhist, like serene way where you're just not identical to your experiences, and you're not identical to this like self that you are imagining yourself to be. But also like what that can do is like make your life way more miserable than it needs to be if you're instead like bending your will to,
it's like the buckling of the couple.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. You're like, yeah, you're buckling like your will, or like yourself, even like this very like, I don't know how relevant this is, but this very like real thing that can happen when you keep giving little bits of yourself up in relationships until like eventually you just kind of, your sense of self collapses, but in a way where like it could go one way, or where you're like in this like Buddhist slash like acidy way where like your sense of self gets dissolved and you're like, no, I am one with everything. Or it could go the other way where like your sense of self gets abolished in a way that is not healthy, and like is just that you're beholden and bending to the will of whoever else you've decided is more important. Or, yeah.
I mean, my first thought for this verse was the use of, like, recycled materials, the cardboard in the old magazines, as maybe like a reference to reincarnation.
Oh, cool. I like that.
And it's something that occurs maybe after our narrator's death. It's post-murdering stake. But it's also very rebuilding, like, and it ties back to the John Donne poem and the idea that we as individuals are more than the sum of our parts. And the line that I had written here was, "Each man's death diminishes me, for I am involved in mankind." And I kind of interpreted that to mean, or projected it to mean, that we are the sum of our parts and experiences. And in this specific reincarnation, I feel like the narrator is being reconstructed very loosely, maybe from the experience of others, or with feelings that they have had before, or thoughts that they've had before. And like you said, like the kind of giving in to others' free will being rebuilt in that way by the opinions of others.
Right.
And also the use of the past tense here, in the place where I stood.
Yeah.
Kind of bugged me. Like, the narrator used to stand there but doesn't anymore. And then, you know.
Yeah, because that's not consistent. So right. She says, the system of strings tugs on the tip of my wings. And then in the place where I stood.
So it's something that we're thinking back on. And like, as you're describing this chopping of the wood, you know, it's an unemotional chore that this person is undertaking. It's something that uses their body, but, you know, just because you're chopping wood doesn't mean you're mentally present in any sense.
Right.
Yeah, even if it is in the past tense here.
Yeah, again, there are like it's like sort of ambiguous to me, maybe, between these two ways in which you might be detached from something. So on the one hand, you can be detached in this way that, like, Buddhists aspire to be detached, which is like just seeing everything as this whatever experience that happens to the oneness, this thing that you have to go through, given that you're like embodied as a human. But that, like, you shouldn't be tugged in the direction of, like, you shouldn't be too affected by, like, the temptations of getting, like, tired or exhausted or frustrated or whatever, right? But there's also this detachedness that is fucking cold and scary, and I don't think is a healthy, right, kind of detachment, where instead you've deadened yourself to whatever's going on. And it's like, for sure, a coping mechanism to deaden yourself to the world like that, but to be just sort of unresponsive in a way that is not a result of having been enlightened. It's just a masculine tactic, but also like masculine coded, obviously, like, of course women can be that way, but like it's very much, to me at least, associated with like masculineness and being like cold and not leaning into your emotions and just detaching yourself from the way that things are rather than facing them, like pretending things are cool.
And these last two verses really highlight the mention of you. Like, in my mind, it is like a finger pointing at someone. You ought not, which you chop and you stack in your barrow. Like, the narrator is not a part of this, maybe is just present in some sense, but as an observer, as an audience, maybe. And then also that just like the chopping of wood is kind of like a monotonous, somewhat domestic task. And we talked a lot about that at the end of Monkey and Bear. Her apron full of boulders, the sloughing of tomatoes, the mending of the threadbare coat. And then also
balletic, diluvian shoulders.
And then also just like the gender roles that are involved when we're talking about those kind of like traditionally feminine tasks versus the wood chopping.
Yeah, that's like a very traditionally masculine coded, but like also domestic task. Yeah.
Heavy-butted and wild-eyed.
You're so cute in the way that you say butted rather than booted. It's the cutest thing I've ever heard.
I wanted to emphasize the t sound in that one.
I love it, though. And heavy-butted.
And streaked with soot. So the genius... Yeah. Notes on this one just brought our attention to the next verse, the slow lip of fire moving across the prairie. And then also in only skin, the fire moves away that we'll tackle at some time in the future. Who knows how long this episode's going to be. And then as I crash through the rafters, as the ropes and the police trail after, it's that idea of like either those visible or the invisible wires having some control over the bird, over the narrator. And like this kind of freeing of some kind of bondage, the ropes and the pulleys behind them, set free.
I have spent an inordinate amount of time trying to parse this verse. For some reason, I can't, legit just can't get past, not metaphorically, I get stuck here and then keep going on these tangents because it seems to me like such an important verse and one that I just don't know
how to handle. That's okay.
That's okay. Yeah. So the part with the, streaked with soot. Let's talk about fire first. So streaked with soot. Holiest belfry burns sky high. Next verse is, and then a slow lip of fire moves across the prairie with precision. And just and one more thought to throw into the mix here before I start saying more is that she has said explicitly, and we have talked about explicitly, how water is a huge theme throughout this album. And the opposite, right, of water is fire. Yeah. And so sort of these like really big themes of these like contrasting forces out in the world, I feel like is something that she's trying to draw our attention to here in a way that I'm not even sure needs to be put into more words than that. Like there's these like contrasting forces that are like battling against each other all the time and that we have to deal with as embodied beings on this earth. But given that this is a podcast in which we have endeavored to talk about more than that. I do think that the genius annotation is onto something when they say like, well, look, if this person is streaked with soot, heavy booted and wild eyed, like that to me means that they've been through some shit. They're streaked with soot. They're heavy booted and booted. saying it the Canadian way now. And wild eyed. Like being wild-eyed to me makes me think of a person who's been through a traumatic situation and is coming out like sort of like still fucking strung out, you know? And then streaked with soot sort of reinforces that where like
they've walked through the fire. Yeah.
They've walked through the fire.
And also the wild-eyed to me speaks to like a kind of like a reflection of the higher self as they're undergoing this super repetitive, monotonous chore. Like maybe their body is doing this thing, but their mind is doing this other thing. And then the specific use of the holiest belfry. It's not just any belfry that's burning sky high. And I can't help but want to reference it to the church from the Myth of Yeast.
Yes.
One that like the first person who sees a church's spire or hears the sound of its bells will become king of the city and all of its territory. So it was like the burning down of this belfry, the opportunity to hear these bells again. Is it drowning out the sound like it was at the beginning of the song?
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I have like 5 different points next to my holiest belfry like notes in my notebook. So one, the first one is like, who the fuck knows? Mm-hmm. I don't know what's going on mm-hmm. here. Second mm-hmm. is the literal burning of a building. So it could be that she's literally describing like, it even like harkens back to like the spires in Emily mm-hmm. where she's talking about. So like yes. these like whatever, these church things now just being destroyed, like literally the buildings themselves being destroyed. Next point is like, well, who started this fire? Mm-hmm. Is it an accident or did the dude start it?
I mean,
it?
He's strict with soot, so.
He's strict, right. He seems guilty. He has some blood on his hands except for soot on his boots. Soot on his boots.
Could turn this into a true crime podcast.
Exactly. You got it. I'm into that. Also, I'm rewatching The Office right now. Have you seen The Office?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so where Dwight's like, Ryan started the fire. It was always burning since the world was turning. Anyways. Okay. And then also, like, is she crashing through the rafters because the belfry is burning? Mm. And so, like, the belfry is burning. She was in this burning building and was at the top of it with the bell mm-hmm. or something and is now crashing through because the rest of it is crumbling. Also, just in terms of what we should associate with fire, there is the fire moving away, as you had mentioned, mm-hmm. Sam, like in Only Skin. There is fire as like this very scary, destructive force. But then there's also like fire as in desire.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's like a Backstreet Boys song. Like, you are my fire, my one desire. So stupid. But like, anyways, it's very like not a secret that these things are associated with each other. And then lastly, my note about this line is that as you had emphasized, Sam, like that it's the holiest mm-hmm. of all the belfries and that it's burning sky mm-hmm. high, like makes me think of God a little bit. So is this belfry just a metaphor for this one greater being that sort of is the person who dictates in the way that maybe a belfry would mm-hmm. who lives and who dies and at what time they're going to die?
The pulling
and
of the strings.
Is it the what?
Pulling of the strings.
The pull, right, mm-hmm. exactly. The pulling of the strings. And in Emily, I had talked a lot about how, to me, the song is very much about what it's like when you lose your faith in God
sure.
that you've sort of like relied upon for your whole life. And if that's the case, then I can sort of impart that interpretation over into this song when we're talking about the holiest belfry burning sky high. So the holiest belfry just equating to God. And like, if you've given that up, like the idea of God burns and it's sky high as in like it's a colossal destruction that is happening.
And I think it was in Emily that, and I think it was you who described like yawning into the void as that like
the sky that is gaping.
Yeah. And just having that in front of you and burning that down is yeah. some shit.
It's some shit. It's some real shit yeah. that is horrible. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, you guys, so that is going to be it for now. Unfortunately, I found some way to fuck up the audio here. Sam and I originally had recorded an outro for this part 2 of Sawdust and Diamonds, but who knows where that is. So it is just me wishing you guys farewell. But I promise that she shares the same sentiments as I will be expressing here. So just in terms of scheduling stuff, next week we're going to release part 3 of Sawdust and Diamonds, and that is the final part. And then we are moving on to the gigantic, enormous, super intimidating task that is Only Skin. So we've already recorded all those episodes, but don't let that stop you from sending in your thoughts about Only Skin or Cosmia stuff. We've also already recorded the episode about the East's album art, but again, like, editing's a miraculous thing. So if you have thoughts that you want to add on to it, it is not too late. Please send them to us at our email at ahopelessendeavor@gmail.com. Endeavor is spelled E-N-D-E-A-V-O-R. And then after we're done with the episode on the East artwork, we're going to do an episode on Colleen. So please send us your thoughts on that. And then we're going to start with Have One On Me. So obviously starting with Easy and working our way through that. So you guys have a whole bunch of options of stuff to send us if you're interested in doing so. And please just know, like, we truly, truly, truly love receiving your guys' thoughts and theories. And, like, no matter how half-baked they are, don't hesitate to send them to us. We really love hearing from you guys. And, like, this is why we made the podcast, right, is just to be able to hear different people's perspectives and opinions. And talking about it with each other really does help at least me, like, gain a deeper understanding or a deeper appreciation of just the complexity of what's going on in Joanna Newsom's music. So yes, reach out to us. We would love to hear from you. Anyways, thank you for listening. We have a Facebook group at Hopeless Endeavor, the Joanna Newsom podcast. I would love to have you there. Sam runs our Instagram, which is a Hopeless Endeavor podcast. And as I said before, our email is ahopelessendeavor@gmail.com. So that is it for now. We will be back next week with part three, the final part of Sawdust and Diamonds. And yeah, have a great week. Bye, guys. Thanks for listening.